Welcome to episode 88 of the Neuro Experience podcast. I'm Louisa Nicola and I am your host. Today we'll be discussing the 13 things mentally strong people don't do with author Amy Morin. So guys, there's a TED talk that's called The Secret to Getting Mentally Strong. It's been viewed 9 million times, which actually makes it one of the most popular talks of all times. And it was presented by psychotherapist Amy, who is sitting here with me at the Everlast headquarters. She's here to talk about her book. She's also here to talk about and break down those 13 things that mentally strong people just don't do. Because this is a mental performance podcast, we want to know absolutely everything there is to know by this incredible woman that we can do every single day, things that we can implement so we can become mentally tough, mentally strong, and build out our own mental performance program. Let's get into the episode. Amy, welcome to the Neuro Experience podcast. I'm so excited to have you here at Everlast. Welcome. Are you excited?
I'm super excited. Thanks for having me.
Is this your first time in New York City?
It's not. I come here quite often, actually.
But this is your first time in the Neuro Experience podcast.
It is. So I'm super excited to be in this exact spot.
I'm actually more excited to you than you because I've read a lot about you. I've listened to a lot of your talks and I've read your book. So I'm so excited to delve into this. I'm so excited for the audience to hear all the nuggets of gold that you're going to give them. But before we get into it, can you please tell us, how do you start your morning?
Sure. So I start my morning. I live on a boat. And so
you live on a boat.
I do. I live on a sailboat.
Okay.
So I start my morning by the first thing I do. I'm one of the people that likes to eat breakfast. Pretty much about the time I wake up, I'm like ready to eat. So I eat my bowl of cereal and drink my coffee outside on the deck and just look around. We have dolphins and manatees and there's fish jumping. And
oh my gosh.
That's how I start. I wait till my coffee is done. I take my time. And then when that's over, I dive into work after that.
Wow. So you get clear ocean views every morning.
Right. So I'm on the water. I get an opportunity to be outside. I'm in South Florida, so the weather's good.
Unbelievable.
Almost every single day. So I can go outside and soak it in for a few minutes before the day starts to get busy and crazy.
So I know I'll be contacting you in summertime.
Absolutely.
Okay, so for the people who don't know too much about you, can you please give us a brief background on your history? How'd you get into what you were doing, how you wrote the book, and what you're doing today?
Sure. So I thought I wanted to be a doctor. I was going to be a pre-med student. And about the first day of college, I thought, you know, everybody, we were dissecting cats, and everybody else was really excited to dissect a cat, and I wasn't. And it occurred to me I didn't actually want to be a doctor. I just liked the idea of being a doctor. And so I knew I needed a new major right away and switched, decided, you know, instead of working on the body, why don't I just work on the mind? And majored in social work. And decided, okay, I'm interested in teaching other people how do you become mentally strong and how can I show them how to build mental muscle. And I really thought it was going to be about teaching people what I'd learned in college. But pretty early on in my journey, my mom passed away. And suddenly I was just interested in it from my own perspective. I wanted to know, how come some people go through tough times and they get stuck? And how come some other people go through tough times and they seem to grow from it? Mm. So I started studying everybody who came into my therapy office because I wanted to figure out what's the difference. I had some people that would come in and they would still be optimistic and they were hopeful about the future and they just had this drive. And I had other people who said, you know, 25 years ago something happened to me and I just could never get past it. Mm. And so I realized it wasn't always about what people did. Sometimes it was more about what they didn't do. People who didn't have certain bad habits seemed to be able to bounce back faster. They seemed to get better. They just seemed to be more resilient overall. Mm. And then it was the 3 years to the day, actually, that my mom passed away, that my 26-year-old husband died of a heart attack.
Oh, my God.
And to go through that, it was just so painful and dark and difficult. But by then, I had at least learned lots of stuff from everybody in my therapy office about how do you stay mentally strong? How do you sort of embrace the pain? How do you go through really tough times and not become bitter and angry and that sort of a thing? But it was hard work. It took a long time. And a few years later, I was fortunate. I found love again. I got remarried and life was looking pretty good. And shortly after, my father-in-law was diagnosed with terminal cancer. And I found myself thinking, this isn't fair. How come I have to lose another loved one? I don't want to go through this again. And fortunately, because of everything I've learned, it was that way of thinking wasn't going to be helpful. And so I sat down and I wrote a list of all the things that mentally strong people don't do. And it was like, okay, just don't do these certain bad habits and you can go through this and you can grieve again and you'll be okay. And so I would read over that list whenever I needed it, and I found it really helpful. So I thought, if it helps me, maybe it will help someone else. So I put it on the web, stepped away from the computer thinking maybe it would resonate with a few people, but never imagined it would go viral. And 50 million people read that article.
Oh my gosh. What did you think? How do you just put up an article and 15 million people have viewed it?
So I put it on my own website, and I put it on another website called Lifehack.
Yeah.
And it literally shut down the Lifehack website because they were getting millions of views within just a matter of hours. And then Forbes magazine picked it up and they put it on their website and it got 10 million views on there. And it just kind of spiraled. Celebrities were tweeting it and people were talking about it, and it just kept getting reprinted on these other major news sites. And before I knew it, national news stations were calling me and they're asking me, how did you come up with this list? But there was really no context for the list. It didn't say that it was because I needed the list myself. People thought, oh, you're a therapist, you know this stuff. Nobody knew that I struggled with it too.
Yeah.
And so I was fortunate during that time, a literary agent called and she said, you should write a book. So within a month, I had a book deal, and I was able to sort of then explain the rest of the story, that I didn't write these things because I'd mastered them all. I wrote them because I struggle with them too.
Wow. I just got to say, like, that's an incredible journey. And like, this is why you're helping so many people, because you've actually been there. You've been in the trenches and you've managed to formulate your own strategies to get yourself out of there. And obviously it's helping so many people. Is that what inspired you to write the book?
It was. So I thought, okay, if I can now explain the rest of the story, because I didn't want people to think I was just, you know, again, preaching about this stuff. I wanted people to know, here's the rest of the story. I've been there. I've been through it. And I wanted to make it about hope and inspiration. Mm. And then when the book came out, I was fortunate that, resonated with people. And I got to write a second book, and I just had my third book come out in 36 languages. And now I get to speak to people on a whole new level about what does it mean to be mentally strong.
So I'm so excited to get into it, because it fascinates me, because we were just talking and, you know, you were asking me, you know, what are some of the things that athletes go through? And it's such an array of different things. So what does mentally strong mean to you?
So I think it's really a three-pronged approach. First is about how you think, thinking realistically. We know that you don't want to be filled with self-doubt, but as you probably know, overconfidence can be just as harmful at times. And then it's about your emotions, and that you have some control over how you feel. If you wake up on the wrong side of the bed, you don't have to stay stuck in a bad mood. You can take steps to feel better. But you also don't have to be happy all the time. Sometimes it's about embracing sadness or allowing yourself to be angry, but figuring out, are my emotions helpful or not? Mm-hmm. And when they're not, to know, how do you change it? And the third part is really about your behavior. What steps do you take to be as productive as possible so that you can move forward and make your life or somebody else's life a little bit better?
I'm so happy you brought up the behavior part, and also really recognizing your thoughts, because I think that's where people go wrong. They think, you know, I always preach that you have to do the work. You have to do the mental work, which means if you have a negative thought, you've got to be strong enough to catch it.
Yes.
Because we all, you know, we know that our brains just want to go somewhere towards what's comfortable, and suffering is what we find comfortable, and suffering is negative thoughts. It's like, well, it's actually easier to have a negative thought. So yeah, so that's why it really resonates with me, because when I look at, you know, it's about catching the negative thoughts when they arise, and it's about doing the work day in and day out, because you can't just wake up and believe that everything's going to be fine today, because we don't know. You may walk outside, somebody may punch you in the face. We're in New York City, you know, you never know, anything is possible. But it's like, okay, great. I need to know how I can mask my mind, how I can mask my brain, so when I walk outside, and no matter what hits me, I know I'm going to be okay because I'm doing the work. And I'm so excited to go into your book, The 13 Things That Mentally Strong People Do. And so
don't do.
The 13 things that mentally 13 things that mentally strong people don't do. And get into it, because I know there's so many people, whether you're a corporate, whether you're a mother, you're a father, you're an athlete, I think everybody needs to start agreeing that mental health is just as or even more important than physical health. And I'm trying to get that out there to the world.
Absolutely. And I always tell people, even if you're dealing with a mental illness, if you're battling anxiety or you're dealing with depression, you can still be mentally strong. It's all about the choices you make every day.
Yeah.
We all have room for improvement. And because sometimes people will say, I'm strong enough. Well, it doesn't make sense. It'd be like if you said, I'm physically strong enough, I don't ever need to go to the gym again.
Yeah.
Obviously, that wouldn't work out. Mental strength's the same.
Absolutely. Do you see that there is any type of correlation between, okay, corporates go through a lot of anxiety and then athletes may go through self-doubt? Like, do you see a correlation between that, or do you just think it's a, you know, everyone's got anxiety, everybody's got certain issues?
I think, you know, the more I talk to people, the more I realize that a lot of people just have a lot of anxiety, a lot of belief that they're not good enough. Self-doubt plays a huge role, whether somebody is, you know, an entry-level employee or they tend to be at the top of their game. How many people still deal with that negative voice in their head that somehow they're not good enough?
Does this, okay, I don't know if you listened to this podcast. I did an episode on social media saying that you have to have an emotional license these days to have Instagram, because I'm finding that we go on Instagram, we see a perfect picture, which is just a showreel, and we get so many things. We get caught up. We scroll. We're like, well, she's got a perfect life. She's got the perfect husband. She's got the perfect career. What we don't see is what's going on behind the photo. But that then, just that one image can cause us to have self-doubt and think things in our heads, then get anxiety. And I think that I love social media. It can be good and bad. I'm not blaming it. But I do think that, you know, we're in 2019. The rate of depression has gone up. You know, do you think there is some type of link towards social media and anxiety and depression?
I do. I think, you know, our electronics in general, I mean, just on my way here today, I was noticing how many people are standing on the curb staring at their phones. And we use it as a crutch sometimes. You don't have to be bored. You don't have to be anxious, or you use it to try to cheer yourself up or to calm yourself down. And we just use it so much that we never really experience a lot of emotions. It can be quite numbing when we do that. And then absolutely, when you're looking at social media, sort of the story that you tell yourself about other people, and then what does that mean about you? And often it comes down to, my life isn't as good as other people's lives.
100%. Are you doing this in the hopes that everyone can, you know, manage their mental health better?
Yeah, I think if we all got rid of if we just said, okay, what are my worst mental habits? And you got rid of just one or two of those, all of your good habits become much more effective.
Just one or two? Not all, you know, 25, 50 of them?
I think start with the one or two worst ones, because I see so many people who get caught up on this sort of treadmill where they think, okay, I'm practicing gratitude and I'm working so hard on doing all these other things to make my life better. But then they have, say, a couple of bad habits where they're believing their self-doubt during the day, or they're talking themselves into believing these catastrophic predictions. And all of their good habits just aren't that effective. If you just sort of trim the fat, get rid of the one or two bad habits that are counterproductive, I think then your good habits become much more effective.
I think it's also about doing the right thing the right way. And what I mean by that is, I can hear a lot of people say, you know, Louisa, I'm doing the visualization work, I'm doing the imagery, I'm doing the gratitude, but it's not just about doing it. You've got to really feel it. You know, when I talk about imagery, you've got to involve all the senses. You can't just sit there and just imagine something. That's not how you're going to train and change your brain. You've really got to do it. So I think a lot of people are, you know, saying they're doing the work, but are they really doing the work?
Yes, I agree with that. That a lot of people go through the motions of any sort of self-improvement and think, okay, I did it, and sort of like a check off a checklist without really committing to the work, because it's hard work when you're doing it.
Oh, it's so hard. That's why I tell everybody, you got to start off with your morning routine. Mm-hmm. That's why I'm so big on that. But let's get into the book and let's go through these 13 things. I'm actually nervous about them.
So number one is that mentally strong people don't waste time feeling sorry for themselves.
Ooh.
And, you know, it's different. You know, sadness is okay. Sometimes it can be quite healing to be sad, but it's different when you host a pity party. That's when you start to...
That's like a dwelling. You just dwell.
Right. And so you stop looking for solutions and you just think about how horrible, awful, terrible your life is. And it's usually exaggerated thinking that keeps you from doing anything different.
So what can we do if we're at the pity party?
I think recognizing it and knowing, okay, if I'm stuck here feeling sorry for myself, what can I do to be helpful? rather than call four more people and tell them why you can't change your life, practice gratitude. Just find one small thing that you could do to say, how do I make my life better? And then do it. And you have to actually take some sort of action.
I also think I'm going to add on to everything that you say as my point of view. And that is, if you are one of those people who keeps dwelling and you're at a pity party, type in the third world country and look at starving children, and you'll realize how good your life is. And then also, you're going to die one day.
Yes.
So
yes.
Dwelling is just is not a really good way to go.
Yes, absolutely.
I'm a realist.
Right.
Next one.
That they don't give away their power. And this one is really about saying, okay, I'm in control of how I think, feel, and behave. Because so often we'll give that power away to somebody else. We say, you know, so-and-so makes me feel bad about myself. Mm. Or I have to go do this thing with this person and I don't want to. Or I have to go to work. And, you know, really you don't have to do much in life. And just taking back your power, it's a choice to go to work. And of course, there's consequences if you don't show up. But taking back your power is about saying, okay, I don't have to allow people to affect how I feel about myself. I don't have to blame anybody else for how I spend my time or who I spend it with. I'm in charge of that.
You know, this is interesting because you see this in relationships as well. It's like, well, if they don't call me back, I'm going to have an anxiety attack. And you literally give somebody else your power. So I love that. And it's not adopting a mentally strong persona and attitude when you do give somebody else, full reign of how you should act and feel.
Right.
I love that one.
And the third one is that mentally strong people don't shy away from change.
Ooh,
and so often in my therapy office, I'd see people that were just stuck. But when it came to doing something different, they were terrified. They would say, well, you know, there's no guarantee my life will get better. What if it doesn't work out? But a lot of times it just boiled down to they didn't want to be uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And doing something different required them to feel different. They had to do something. They had to put themselves out there.
It's getting your brain out of that comfort zone.
Right. And what they didn't know, though, is that avoiding discomfort ultimately causes more discomfort. It's this vicious cycle, and they had to actually sort of take this leap of faith. Okay, if I do something different, it's going to be a little uncomfortable, but it's also the key to making your life better.
Yeah, I was actually interviewing this psychiatrist who speaks about happiness, and she was saying that you can't just wake up and be happy. You have to generate it, and in order to generate it, you've got to do things. You know, you've just got to get up and just, you know, it's even the 5-second rule. You just got to get up, count to five, and just get it done. Because you know that the rewards are just going to be even better at the end. And I hear a lot of people saying, you know, I don't like how my life is. I don't like how this is. I don't like how I look. But I do see that a lot of people just don't want to change. They don't want to do the work to change.
Right. Yes, absolutely. The next one is that they don't worry about pleasing everyone. Mm. I've run into a lot of people pleasers. And I think, you know, if we were honest, probably we've all had times in our life or periods in our life where we tend to fall into that trap where we think, okay, how do I make everybody else happy? Or we make decisions based on what we think other people want us to do, but then you lose sight of your values when you do that.
So that's really coming down to knowing who you are, right?
Right, and just being comfortable with not everybody has to like what you do, and some people might not agree with your decisions, but that when you're mentally strong, you know, I'm okay. Even if other people don't think I'm okay, I can still be okay.
It's a fine line because I remember I was in this position, you know, back in my early 20s. I was always trying to please other people. I was trying to please my coach. I was trying to please my parents. I was trying to please my friends. And it really gets you into this. You lose yourself. You lose sight of who you really are. And so it doesn't get you there. But being able to stand up for yourself and saying no to certain people, saying no to certain events, saying no to certain things that don't really serve you, it's kind of a fear because you may think in your head and, you know, subconsciously, if I don't do this, they're not going to like me. Right. I'm going to lose friends and I'm going to lose this. And it can be a scary thing. So no, I completely agree with you on that one.
Yes. For a lot of people, it's tough, but then once you practice, it gets better, it gets easier. Mm. You see that people really don't care as much as you think most of the time.
Nobody cares.
Right. The next one is that they don't fear taking calculated risks. And, you know, I see so many people who I think all of us in general don't know how to calculate risk. We tend to think if something feels scary, it's really risky. And then we don't do it. But then you think about, well, what are all the risks that you take every day? You get in a car, that's actually quite risky. You could get in an accident. But giving a speech really isn't that dangerous, yet most of us fear public speaking. So when you really take a look at, well, how do I make these decisions in my life and to just really make a better understanding of how do you feel when we're excited about something. Sometimes we tend to underestimate risk. That's why we fall prey to, say, a get-rich-quick scheme. But when we're anxious about something, even if it's unrelated decision that we're going to make at work, we tend to overestimate how likely we are to fail. So it's really just about becoming more aware of your emotions, your thoughts, and thinking more about the risks that you take as well as the ones you don't take.
See, a lot of the things you're saying in these points are all related to fear.
Yes.
Everyone's got fear.
Right.
What's fear? Where does that come from?
Right. Boils down to, you know, those catastrophic predictions that we make in our...
These made-up thoughts in your head that do not exist, but you are scared for some reason.
Right. And then we think, okay, well, if the worst happens, I can't handle it. And part of being mentally strong is knowing things aren't going to turn out well all the time. You're going to run into obstacles, but knowing I can be okay even when I do.
You know what I ask myself every day?
What?
I always say, what's the worst? You know, if I'm up with a difficult decision, you know, what's the worst that can happen? And if that thing does not lead to death or death of anybody around me, I go, okay, great. Well, we can get past it. Right. And that's how I've lived my life. And people say, you're so fearless. It's like, well, I'm not fearless. I just really think that, you know, if I do this, what's the, you know, making calls, you know, I didn't even know this, but a lot of people get scared to actually approach people.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, you know, do you just approach it? Yeah. Well, the worst thing they can do is say no.
Right. But I hear that one probably the most. If somebody is afraid to say, you know, I don't dare make that phone call. I don't dare ask that question. I don't want people to judge me.
Yeah. I love that.
So the next one is that they don't dwell on the past.
Yes.
And it's easy to get stuck. You know, when you go through a hard time, when you make a big mistake, somebody hurts you, or something really bad happens, that it's so easy to just replay that over in our heads and to just really not dare move on. And you know, I went through this too after losing my mom and losing my husband. It was like, ugh, moving forward was scary. It was tough. It was almost, you know, like leaving them behind, all sorts of things. But, you know, when for other people, it's just about something that happened to them in childhood and they just can't let it go. But when you stay stuck in the past, you can't enjoy the present. You don't make your future good. It really keeps you bogged down and holds you back.
A lot of people say, you know, Louisa, it took me 8 months to get over him, or it took me 8 months to get over this situation. And it's like, no, it took you 8 months to get to the decision to get over it, because you can really change your state and your mind in literally a moment. You can literally click your fingers and change. But it's the people who decide to do it and keep moving on with that decision.
Yes, absolutely. Like we said before, it's all about that decision you make every day to make those changes.
Stop living in the past.
Right. And the next one is that they don't make the same mistakes over and over again.
Ah, see, look, we're going to ballpark this, because when it comes to mistakes, I believe, the same mistakes, yes. I can see how you wouldn't be too mentally strong if you kept making the exact same mistakes. But I'm a firm believer in making mistakes on the daily, because I think that's what produces somebody who's mentally strong.
Yes, I think so too. And I talk about that sometimes. If you're not embarrassing yourself, if you aren't making mistakes, you probably aren't trying very hard.
100%.
And then it's okay. But to know that you don't have to keep making the exact same mistake, because how often do we say, oh, I'm never going to do that again? And then there's, you know, we jump right back into it too quickly without thinking, how do I do better next time?
I like that.
And so then the next one is that we don't resent other people's success, and which we just talked about with social media. Sometimes we look at other people and we think, how come they have that and I don't? How come their lives are better than mine? Or you just look around at your neighbors, your friends, and you start to get angry that other people seem to be more attractive, they have more money, and that they just seem to be happier. I see a lot of people who are resentful that other people are happy.
I think that comes down to, as well, knowing who you are. I don't think you can generally have any type of desire to be resentful for another person's success, or in any way, you know, she's got that and I don't, if you really are truly happy with who you are. And the reason why we go off track, the reason why we look at other people and think, I want that, is because we generally believe that our lives will be better and we will be happier if we have that thing.
Yes.
But more often than not, when we do get that thing, we're not that happy.
Right.
So it's like this laziness. It's like we're too scared to really find out who we are.
I agree. I think we could easily spend a lot of time just chasing what other people have, thinking
that's what we want. Yeah.
Right.
Stop right. Chasing.
Absolutely. And the next one is that they don't give up after the first failure. Obviously.
Massive.
Most success stories start with a whole long list of reasons and how many times somebody has failed.
Yeah.
And knowing that you can bounce back and get better every time you fail.
100%. I agree with that. The amount of times that I've had a no, I've knocked on someone's door and they've said no, 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 and I, you know, pushed through in the end. That's how I got to where I am today.
Exactly. The next one is that they don't fear alone time. When I talk about this, sometimes people will say, oh, I'm alone all the time. I'll say, well, no. what do you do when you're alone? Yeah. Well, I'm listening to podcasts and I'm texting my friends. And just because they're physically alone doesn't mean that they're spending time alone with their thoughts.
Mm.
And whether it's just 10 minutes a day and you meditate or you write in a journal or you just sit and think, I think it's so important to set aside time to be alone with your thoughts and get comfortable in your own skin.
100%. And not just that, you know, the most powerful thing I ever did, I went on a 10-day, I don't know why I did it, 10-day silent retreat.
Wow.
We had to eat at a certain time. We had to be up at a certain time. We weren't allowed to talk, which, my God, was very hard. You spend so much time with yourself, and it was 10 days. My gosh, the things that you learn about yourself and the things that you go through is astounding. I think that everybody, you know, should do some type of retreat like that. You can't take any phones or anything. It's ridiculous.
I think for most people that would be terrifying.
You see demons coming out of some people. You start hallucinating on like day 5. And then when it comes to day 10 and they're like, you can talk, it's like you don't know how to talk.
Right.
Oh, I love that.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Interesting. The next one is that they don't feel the world owes them anything.
Yes.
Because sometimes it's, you know, you see people who fall into that trap of thinking, well, I worked really hard, so I deserve to be really successful. Or I have this degree, so now I deserve to make a lot of money. Or entrepreneurs who start out and think, well, you know, I put in 3 weeks worth of work, so how come I don't have this huge social media following? And we know what happens when you think that the world owes you more than you're getting. You get angry, you get bitter, and you start wasting your time looking around at other people rather than focusing on, okay, what can I do next to get better?
My take on that is give without expectation.
Yes.
Just keep giving, because the moment that you start expecting things is when the moment that you think that people and the world owe you something. Nobody owes you anything.
Absolutely.
You owe yourself. You owe yourself more than what you think the world owes you. So.
Right. Mm. And then number 13 is that they don't expect immediate results.
Mm.
And this one is...
That's kind of me when I go to the gym.
Right.
I'm like, oh, I did some weights. Why hasn't my body changed?
Well, that goes back to most of us, right? The reason to think, wow, you know, and our world is obviously so fast-paced. You can get almost anything in a day or two. You know, if you order something online, you want something, we want it now. And then we think, okay, self-improvement should only take a couple of days. And by Wednesday, you don't see results and you throw in the towel sometimes. And so it's just about knowing what's a realistic expectation. How do I actually change myself, whether we're talking physically or mentally, and then putting in the time to get there.
So what can we just say? Let's pick one thing, because there's a theme that I see a lot about, especially when, you know, with my clients on social media, anxiety. Let's just pick that as a ballpark. What can somebody do if they're suffering, whether it's, you know, extreme anxiety, whether it's just mild on the daily? What can somebody do every single day to start avoiding, or I would say to get on track with eliminating that anxiety?
Yeah, so I guess it would depend on exactly what somebody was afraid of, but maybe it's that they shy away from change. So even though they're anxious, they're going through the exact same thing all day, every day. So I'm going, okay, what can I change? What can I do differently? What's something I can try? I'm a big fan of having behavioral experiments. Let's see if something else works. Just try it. Ask yourself, if I didn't have anxiety, what would I be doing differently? Act as if you didn't have anxiety. Maybe it's scary to make a phone call, so you're going to act as if you were confident. Go ahead and make that phone call anyway. And sometimes just those little changes make a big difference to somebody, knowing that anxiety is not the end of the world.
Mm.
Just because you feel anxious doesn't mean something bad is going to happen.
Mm.
And that you can tolerate a little bit of discomfort, and by putting yourself out there, life can get better.
Exactly. I think as well, it's when I say the daily rituals, it's the what are you eating, the how much are you sleeping, what's the negative thought stopping that you have, are you journaling, are you surrounding yourself by good people, because all of this stuff really adds to the anxiety mixture. So I think it comes down to the physical work as well.
Absolutely.
So tell me, even though you've given us so much information, what's the one piece of advice that you could give somebody so they could change their life?
I think to pay attention to the way you think, and it all boils down to that. Just being more aware of how you're thinking and recognizing how those negative thoughts affect how you feel and affect how you behave.
Do you think that we should start to get into a journaling, you know, habit where we think, you know, because I think about what I'm thinking and but then I forget about what I'm thinking. So should I start to write down, hey, Louisa, this morning you were having these thoughts?
I think it's really helpful for a lot of people to do that if they're doing it correctly. I run into some people who are journaling, but they're sort of just journaling in a way that they're talking about all the bad things that happened to them.
Yeah.
And that gets them caught up more in the self-pity trap. But if you can start paying attention to what kind of thoughts do you have, which kinds of ones are repetitive? Do you call yourself the same name every single day? And when people become more aware of the type of thoughts they have, they start to recognize, you know, gosh, I have all these thoughts all the time. And day in and day out, you tend to think the same things over and over. We think you have something like 60,000 thoughts. And quite often, those thoughts are the same things over and over again. So just recognizing what are the types of thoughts that you have, which ones are repetitive, which ones aren't true, and what can you do about them?
That is incredible. I think that everybody should be getting on that bandwagon. Tell us about the other books that you've got coming out.
So after my first book came out, the biggest question I kept getting was, how do we teach kids how to be mentally strong?
Yes!
And so I wrote the parenting book to help parents know, how do you raise mentally strong kids? I wanted parents to know how to become a coach for their kids. So 13 Things Mentally Strong Parents Don't Do was book number two. And after that book came out, the biggest question I kept getting was from women saying, okay, well, what does it look like to be a mentally strong woman in today's world? Because I think a lot of the examples that we have of toughness is a Navy SEAL or it's a male athlete. Women wanted to know, what does it look like to be a strong woman? And I thought, oh, absolutely. So my new book is 13 Things Mentally Strong Women Don't Do.
I love that. Where can we find out more information on how we can get this, how we can get in touch with you?
My website is amymorin, LCSW, as in licensed clinical social worker.com, and it's got more information about my books and what I do and social media links on there.
Oh, we're also going to provide all the links in the footnotes of this episode. Amy, I've loved this episode. Thank you so much for being part of the Neuro Experience.
Thanks for having me.